Hello, and welcome to Awin Talks, the affiliate and partner marketing podcast. I'm your host, Rob Davidson from Awin's global strategy team, and I'm joined today by my usual accomplice, Kevin Edwards, Awin's global strategy director. Hi, Kev. How are you?
Hi, Rob. Yeah, I'm not too bad. How are you doing?
Yeah, not bad. Thanks. Not bad at all.
Excellent.
On today's podcast, we're delighted to have a couple of guests from across the Atlantic join us to tell us more about the state of the US market currently. So first up, we're going to be taking a very wide macro view on the industry there, as we have Tricia Meyer from the Performance Marketing Association joining us to tell us about some of the findings from their recently published Performance Marketing Industry Study. Now, the PMA is the trade body for the industry in the States, and this is the second time that they've actually published such a report. So it's an invaluable resource because it provides a really detailed, quantified view on how businesses are actually using affiliates and partnerships to grow based on the contributions of some of the biggest platforms out there, of which both Awin and ShareASale were too. So Kevin and I spoke to Tricia about the results from that report and asked her what she felt the findings really told us about the health of the industry today in the States. You've obviously been involved to a degree in the production of that report, Kev, and have had a good read through the findings. What were your main takeaways from our conversation with Tricia, as well as the report itself?
Well, first off, I think it's really great that the PMA is able to find the funding to keep doing this. We did the first one in 2018, and then because of the pandemic, I think Tricia explains a little bit later, there was kind of a bit of a delay in producing the next one. But and it bits of work like this aren't cheap. It's not just, you know, them going out and asking people for some numbers. They have to employ the services of PwC to do it. So, you know, good quality research like this is expensive to do. So it's great that we have one market at least that's really investing in trying to find this kind of information. For me, a couple of kind of key takeaways. One is that the industry has shown really bullish growth, 50% growth in 3 years. Which outstrips the market generally. I think that digital marketing globally only grew by about 2% in 2020. Obviously, there was kind of a bit of real sort of dip in certain industries, and that was inevitably going to bounce back a bit in 2021. But, you know, affiliate marketing kind of, as we've said and on this podcast before, but as we've also posted on our blog before, that the affiliate channel has been pretty resilient through the pandemic in sort of maintaining decent growth and decent numbers. Some of the data is inevitably modeled. I think we had one company fewer than the last time we did it who actually submitted their numbers. But again, that's what we pay PwC to do. They go out and model the rest of the industry. As you say, I was involved in producing the report, but I was involved in kind of planning of what we measure and how we segment. And I think that, again, this is something that Tricia talks about, but it's difficult to do year-on-year or survey-to-survey comparison because obviously we work in a dynamic industry where we're seeing kind of new entrants come in all the time, and we're also constantly looking at whether the classification is up to scratch. So it's difficult to make some comparisons. But as a general yardstick, I think that there are some really decent numbers in there. It goes into kind of quite a bit of detail around the affiliate segmentation. I think also for me, one thing that we're kind of approaching that magic double digit figure in terms of revenue generated. So, you know, for every $100 spent in retail, we're kind of fast approaching the $10 is being spent through the affiliate channel. So, when we get there eventually, hopefully in the next couple of years or so, I think that's going to be a really powerful stat. I think also one thing that we also need to be mindful of is that there's a bit of a disconnect between that and the ROI numbers, because you know, we're a very efficient channel, which means that we can talk about amazing ROI numbers of 12 retail dollars created for every one spent. But we also know that other channels kind of hit maybe $2 or $3, $4, $5 for every dollar spent, which means that they are typically getting a much larger share of marketing budgets even though they're not necessarily generating a high volume of sales. So that's kind of just one thing, one sort of takeaway that is like our perennial challenge, I think, as the affiliate channel, about how we make sure that our share of voice extends beyond the revenue that we're generating. And actually, it was kind of, that was sort of borne out in our own piece of research that we did recently. We kind of went out and asked a few hundred digital marketers globally around about how they perceive the affiliate and the partner channel as well. And actually, of the 14 channels that we asked about, the affiliate and the partner channel, actually we've seen very positively for ROI. So we know that there's a story around ROI to go out and talk about. We know it's always been one of our real strengths. But for me, those two kind of things coalesce to maybe think that we need to be building a much stronger narrative around it.
Yeah. Do you think there's a tension there, though, that almost like a paradoxical tension, in that as we try to maybe draw in more of that marketing budget and investment into the channel, then the pressures on the ROI being as efficient as it has been historically might mean that it starts to decline a little, particularly, I guess, when we talk a lot about trying to increase maybe investment around more brand awareness campaigns, where the ROI is less directly connected to a lot of the activity that the channel has historically been so associated with.
Well, I mean, I guess the beauty of the channel is that it is so responsive, in that, you know, you have this lever, in that you can say, actually, I am going to invest in brand stuff here with maybe this cohort of publishers, and I'm willing to run it at maybe half the ROI of the rest of the program, but your blended ROI is still going to come out at a pretty compelling level. And, as you know, that's kind of what we always say to advertisers when they start, you know, when they ask what commission level should I set my commission at. It's like, well, what margin have you got to play with? And whatever that kind of higher level is, then that's your kind of upper limit. And really, you can work your ROI back from that. And so I guess it's, you know, it's that natural evolution. As we talk about more and more branding opportunities coming into the channel, then yes, we will couch those in less ROI focused terms, but it's a channel that has multiple levers, and there are ROI levers and there are more brand-based levers. And as long as you kind of can come out, as long as you have good reporting whereby you're aware of what your blended ROI is, then I think that it will always remain that sort of compelling but also very transparent channel.
Well, from that macro perspective of the industry report that Tricia talks to us about, we then actually descend to a much narrower one. When I got the chance to chat with Joe Sanfilippo at the US agency Today's Business. Now, they've recently been nominated for the Best Content Partnership accolade at the new US Partnership Awards for their work with Awin client Tomahawk Shades, a Long Island-based sunglasses brand. I spoke to Joe about how they went about creating this hugely successful content campaign via affiliate partnerships, and he revealed some really interesting strategies that they used to make it such a success. And talking of the US Partnership Awards, it's only right that we highlight the fact that Awin and Shareasale have had 5 nominations shortlisted for the inaugural awards ceremony, which is being held in New York on September 7th. So a couple of days from today when we're recording. By the time this episode is published, we should actually know what the result of those awards are. So fingers crossed for Joe and his team, and obviously all of our Awin US colleagues. For now, though, let's move on to our interview. So later, I speak to Joe at Today's Business, as just mentioned. But first, here's our chat with Tricia Meyer, Executive Director at the Performance Marketing Association. Hi, Tricia. Thanks for joining the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's one of my favorite topics these days.
Whereabouts do we find you today? Where are you based?
I'm in Indianapolis, Indiana. So kind of smack dab in the middle of the country.
Okay. Probably a good kind of symbolic location for somebody who's judging the whole industry in the US.
Absolutely. It's nice just to kind of be in the middle of everything.
Well, to move on, we obviously got you onto the podcast today to talk about the new PMA report that's been published very recently. And this is the first study on the US market since 2018, when you did your very first one as a trade body. Before we get into talking about the results and some of the kind of findings that you found interesting within that, can you just talk a bit about some of the hurdles that you faced in actually getting the new research commissioned and published? Because I know that it is a big logistical undertaking.
Sure, absolutely. Obviously, trying to get the cooperation of everyone at the same time is difficult. People are on different fiscal calendars. Everyone's kind of in different places. So trying to just get that cooperation across all of the networks. We've also had some consolidation across the industry, in particular at the network levels. So trying to figure out how to deal with that, whether we consider those the same companies, separate companies, things like that. The confidentiality means a lot of finance. So just for us, and you know, in a difficult time during the pandemic when we're trying to figure out, is this something that we can finance when we really aren't sure what's going on with everything? Or do we want to hold off just a little bit until things are more stable? And then trying to figure out kind of when the numbers would become more stable. You know, we were set to do the survey last year as we had initially planned. It would be every 2 years. But because we just weren't confident that the numbers were really stable enough, we decided to push it the extra year.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, to dive into those results that eventually were published, what were the kind of top level ones that for listeners who may not have read it, they might find them to be the most kind of headline grabbing figures?
So the biggest headline and what we originally were looking for with that first study was that we wanted to estimate the total affiliate marketing spend in the United States. And for the 2018 numbers, we were at $6.2 billion, and we were hoping for a 10% annual growth rate. And we ended up at $9.1 billion, which was actually a 47% increase over those other results. So that was a compound annual growth of almost 14%, which did exceed what we were hoping for at the 10% level. So that kind of overarching number was the big one that we were all holding our breath and hoping that we would end up seeing the growth that we had been hoping for and that we've been seeing in the years previous. And then, you know, some of the other kind of lower things that are still really important. One of the biggest ones, I think, just for our entire industry is that 12-to-1 average return on ad spend, because it's one of the things that we tout about our industry, you know, how dependable, stable, low risk we are, is that return on ad spend. And that 12-to-1 stayed consistent from the last time we did the survey. And then I would say the other big number that came out of it was we saw that cashback and loyalty sites were the highest publisher channel with 38% of ad spend, which is really significant. And then followed by coupons and voucher sites at 16%. So, you know, the combination of cashback, loyalty, coupon, voucher ended up being over 50% total.
So do you think that most of the growth that we've witnessed over that period of time is coming from those partners, or is it more diverse than that?
It's definitely more diverse than that. I think we saw an increase there in particular over the last year, just because people are becoming more savvy with their money. You know, with recessions pending, people are trying to stretch their money more. We saw people looking for the cashback coupon toolbars, extensions, anything that would make it easier to save money while shopping online. And obviously shopping online, saving more than just shopping locally and not being able to compare prices quite as much. So more online shopping meant more online savings, but we also were seeing increases in other places at the same time. So we're seeing increases in different types of technology affiliates. We're seeing other media houses that were joining that previously weren't doing affiliate marketing. So it's hard to tell right now where we're headed with that, if we're going to continue to see that the cashback coupon continue to increase as we're still in this kind of recessionary economy for the next year, and then what will happen after we pull out of that.
And I mean, were there any other major factors that you think are driving the growth in the industry currently? Because obviously, you know, the last two and a half years have been a very weird world in which to live, and they've massively impacted the economy. They've massively impacted consumer behavior, driven a lot of interest initially kind of online. And we saw some massive growth for a lot of companies, and that growth for e-commerce and the wider digital space is maybe kind of reining back again now that the world is settling into some semblance of normality, if we can call today's world normal. But do you think that all of those factors must have contributed to that growth as well? Do you think that they're the major contributors, or are there other levers and kind of sources of where that growth has come from?
Those are definitely some of the big things. Some of the technology that I mentioned that, you know, plays into what's happening in terms of recession, but also technology is like buy now, pay later is something that we're seeing an increase in, especially with, you know, my daughters are college age and all they talk about is how all their friends do buy now, pay later. It's like the, you know, the layaway of my generation is the buy now, pay later of the new generation. And Affiliate is, you know, jumping into that with both feet and seeing how they can leverage that. So that is something new that we're seeing that's almost more generational technology than necessarily the pandemic based. Also mobile marketing, the fact that performance marketing has found a way to track mobile marketing spending. So it makes it very lucrative for these retailers knowing that people are shopping on their phones and that we can find ways to measure that and have that data for them to be able to consistently make sure that they're putting their money in the right place. Also, obviously, just the risk in investment in affiliate marketing compared to other types of ad spend like CPM and paid placements. You know, when companies are really being judicious with their advertising dollars right now and trying to figure out where to put smaller amounts of money to keep their companies profitable, affiliate marketing is low risk when it's performance-based because there's not a lot of upfront investment, you know, with the exception of the technological investment of getting the links out there, there's not a lot of upfront investment until they see those sales. So I think it's just the low risk high return on ad spend is making it something that more retailers that we had never seen in the past are getting involved in, even other types of verticals like automotive and business services that we weren't seeing as much before the pandemic. We're seeing more of that now.
I was going to say, one of the benefits, I think, of doing the survey, of having this three-year gap is that, you know, when you're working day to day in it, you don't necessarily see those kind of more incremental changes, but obviously the three-year space does give you kind of like a real contrast that you can make. And one of the things that you reference in the report is that growing diversity of the publisher base. I mean, obviously you've talked specifically around buy now, pay later and the tech partners, but also the growth of media partners as well. And also influencers coming, you know, becoming a lot more mainstream as well. So I think that for me, what the report really demonstrates is how healthy that diverse mix is now. And I think that those concerns that people potentially had a few years ago about sort of, you know, the prevalence of coupons and cashback is now maybe there are very viable alternatives that now do exist.
Absolutely. And in addition to that, the overlap between different types of publishers, because you might have people that are looking for coupons, but some of these other types of publishers are figuring out how to work those coupons into their content creation better as well. So part of our challenge in trying to, you know, categorize all of this, and obviously, you know, at the network level, you're having the same thing is how do I categorize an influencer that's influences in coupons? Are they a coupon site or are they an influencer? They're putting out these coupons on social media, but does that make them an influencer? Does that make them social media? You know, how do we categorize them? So, you know, in some sense, the numbers give us these kind of big pictures of where to start looking, but then we really have to start, you know, diving down individually within the networks and talking to the different retailers and figuring out who it is that they're working with and where they're being categorized.
Yeah, that's something we've actually talked about previously on the podcast is that, you know, we need these categories and these labels to be able to make some kind of conception of what's going on in the market right now. But there is a degree to which you need to look past those surface labels because there is so much nuance going on underneath that needs to be accounted for as well. I'd be interested to know whether or not there were any findings that you were particularly surprised by in this study compared to, say, the last one, and maybe that contradicted what your assumptions might have been and your expectations for the state of the market.
The biggest one was content and having that decrease in the percentage going to the content publishers. And, you know, part of it is that fear of, oh no, is this going to be what everybody now uses to say content is dead? But so we were kind of worried in the beginning about that and how people were going to take that. So we did take the time to work with PwC and with the networks who are contributing the data to figure out what exactly was happening there. And part of it was just in the way we changed the categories because we did move influencer out of content into that social creator category. So that moved a little bit of percentage points over there. But something else that we saw was that subnetworks went up quite a bit. And when we dug a little bit further into that, we found that some of the mainstream media companies that were not previously doing affiliate are now using subnetworks to monetize. And that also a lot of the influencers that weren't doing it before are now using subnetworks. So it will be interesting to see where that shakes out in 2 years. Will those influencers and mainstream media just continue to work through the subnetworks because it's easier for them? Or will they find that, you know, working directly with the retailers through the networks as opposed to through the subnetworks is more lucrative financially for them and, you know, creates better partnerships? It could definitely go either way.
Yeah, that's definitely something that I think we've witnessed in recent years with media houses taking the channel that much more seriously, that they are realizing and recognizing the value of the channel, and particularly when they have the resource internally, which they've invested in, that they then start to build out those internal teams. And then once you have the resource, you can then start to maybe take more control around those partnerships directly rather than, you know, maybe doing it through more of an automated solution like a subnetwork can offer.
And they definitely dipped their toes in a little bit more during the pandemic, you know, because everyone was trying to find new ways to make money. There were less paid placements by a lot of retailers during that time because, you know, shopping was so speculative across the board. And so they were dipping their toes in, and, you know, you do have to have that internal investment. You can't just, you can't be an influencer who does everything, who's doing their social, who's making videos, who's producing their content, and who understands how to work with every different network and pull links and all of that. So the sub networks really are a nice way to introduce people to affiliate marketing and show them the value.
Looking at it from, because you do provide a sector breakdown as well, and retail inevitably continues to be this dominant sector as far as ad spend and revenue generation are concerned within the channel. You mentioned automotive earlier. Do you see other sectors actually making a dent into retail's dominance in the future? Or do you think that that dominance is just an inherent result of the fact that it's a sector that aligns really well with e-commerce and the kind of wider performance advertising model?
Retail is the easiest to track the data and to be able to give the numbers. For example, you know, travel was still a 21, I think, to one return on ad spend, even during a time where there wasn't a lot of travel. And so that's pretty significant. But other things like financial services, we see it happening, but it's just harder to track the revenue there because those are long-time customers. So when you're paying, a retailer's paying $100 for someone to sign up for, you know, a credit card or a brokerage account or something like that, we don't see that revenue number coming back through affiliate marketing. So it's harder to substantiate. So we're still seeing those numbers coming in on the spend side. We just have to dig a little bit deeper, I think, working with those different retailers to find out what their actual return on ad spend is over time. And I think that once we're able to start doing that with them, I think we'll find that, you know, performance-based marketing does work for other sectors like them as well.
Yeah, I guess that's a question of measurement and attribution again, isn't it? And as those tools and technologies become more sophisticated and more widely adopted as a default means by which of running an affiliate program, for instance, you can start to encourage more of those advertiser sectors that have got a wider lead-in time and the customer journeys are that much more complex, like travel, for instance, which can involve so many different touch points over such a long period of time. And I know that as someone that has booked travel online and nearly pulled my hair out trying to find a hotel room that's available in the city that I want to go to a certain time of the year. So it's, I guess it's going to be in tandem with those technologies becoming more normalized.
Definitely.
So were there any trends that you saw in this year's report that really excite you about the current direction of the industry and where it's heading, and that the next time it comes to doing this, whether that's kind of in the next couple of years or 3 years or so, like, that you would expect to see maybe more established?
I think, as you mentioned, that diversification, in particular with the publisher types. We saw that the, you know, the other, what we just listed as other in the report, that publisher channel grew its share. And, you know, we're going to have to take a look at everything that we categorize as other and figure out what now needs to be broken into their own categories because they're growing as well. Seeing the technology partners, the way that they're integrating with the retailers, the way that they're, you know, retailers, things that they used to try to do themselves, but that they're finding that they can actually, it's better for them to allow affiliate partners to do some of that retargeting, remarketing for them, whether it's via email or the buy now, pay later, or those different types of things. I think we're going to continue to see a lot of growth in those. And so I think it's just that diversification as a whole, because that's what makes our industry healthy. It's bringing in new retailers, new retailer types, new publisher types, and making it easy for them. You know, we're seeing obviously that subnetworks grew, which means things are still a little bit tricky for people that are coming into the industry, especially who don't have the resources on their teams to have a one person who's devoted to nothing but figuring out how to do affiliate marketing. So we have to continue to lower those entry barriers. And that way, as we're diversifying, we're continuing to help those people get in and actually be successful early on.
Yeah, absolutely. And it feels like as well with the, you've almost kind of highlighted two ends of the customer journey in a way, or the traditional customer journey in the report and where that growth is. I think influencers, they came in at like a fivefold increase from the previous report in 2018, which is obviously from a low base, but it's still kind of impressive growth that we've seen there. And the fact that it's been split out as its own separate category is indicative of that growing trend. So you've got that brand inspiration and awareness stuff going on as far as those guys are concerned. And then arguably, we talk in Awin at least about this idea of the kind of like the customer journey. You go through the traditional funnel. And a lot of traditional affiliate is this traffic arbitrage where you have partners and publishers of different varieties and types handing over traffic for advertisers to convert on their own websites. And that's how the traditional dynamic of affiliate has always kind of operated. But with technology partners, what you're starting to see is that actually affiliate partners can also enhance your customer experience or your user experience on a retailer's website. And that suddenly opens up a whole new kind of scope in terms of what affiliate value looks like and can be defined as, because it's all about the customer experience on your website. It's about optimizing. It's about upselling. It's about resolving customer queries or maybe reducing returns and all these great enhancements that you can implement on your website. And so you can see, I think, how the industry is evolving in the growth happening at those two ends of the spectrum, if you like. And I think that that's a really exciting thing that I'd love to kind of see that has grown the next time it comes around to doing this kind of report.
I was just gonna say one other point as well. Like, I think it is really interesting how we're seeing brands evolve how they perceive the affiliate channel, you know, very much away from sort of last click wins, you know, from kind of years and years and years ago, to this idea that it is a far more sort of holistic channel. And I also, something else that we're seeing on both sides of the Atlantic is this kind of idea by brands that they can partner with other brands as well to run performance-based activity. And also, it might not necessarily be to generate revenue. It might be to drive customer loyalty. And so again, that's another aspect of kind of expanding the sort of capability and the diversity of the channel. So, you know, you're now able to have kind of multiple conversations with advertisers about what are your core challenges and then trying to find the right solutions that fit whatever those challenges are.
Definitely. I mean, from your perspective, Tricia, what value do you think that a study like the PMAs plays in terms of the industry's actual growth?
I think first, it encourages retailers that have been reluctant to enter the performance marketing space. It encourages them to dip their toes in, to invest a little bit, to look a little bit more closely when they see that return on ad spend, when they see their sector being listed in there and how well those sectors are doing. I think it encourages them to come in and join us. I think it also really helps legitimize the channel, because the term affiliate marketing in the United States has not always been one that's associated with being extremely legitimate, just because of early players that didn't really have anything to do with what we're doing. And so, you know, we kind of use the terms performance-based marketing and affiliate marketing interchangeably throughout the report and through everything that we're doing, because we want people to understand that performance-based marketing is like the best of affiliate marketing. So this report really helps us legitimize that. And then I think it just gives everybody some metrics to compare their own companies against, whether you're a retailer and, you know, of your return on ad spend is not what you're seeing for your sector in this report. You need to go back to whoever's running your program and say, hey, what are we doing here? Where can we do some optimization? If you're a network that, you know, you're mainly working with content and you look at this and say, maybe we should take a look at some of these coupon and cashback sites again, or vice versa. And so I think it's just, it's really good for all of us that are in the industry as well, that we can look at some of these, we can identify opportunities in places where we may not be making much money right now. We might not have a lot of partnerships, and you wonder, you know, wow, games and toys, 18-1. Why am I not pushing games and toys more? If that's obviously something that has a great return on ad spend, why am I not doing more with that? So I think just overall, and then the cooperation, lastly, I think that something like this shows that we all can work together and that we're all working together to make the industry better. It's not just a cutthroat industry where everybody's having to, you know, watch their backs. It's something where we are all trying to work together to grow the industry. And I think that lends confidence to people that want to start working in it because they see how collaborative it is and how many of us really are working toward the greater good.
Great. Other plans for the future? I don't want to kind of like immediately put the ball back onto your side of the court, but do you have plans? Have you thought about the next version of this?
As long as we can get the funding, I would love to see us do it in 2 years. I've already received the messages from PwC about what their team will look like and what first steps would be for that. So as long as we can get it funded, I think that we will do it again in 2 years. We know now maybe to break things down in some different places, which obviously it causes problems every time we break things down a little differently because the comparisons are a little different. But it also means that each report gets a little better than the one before because we do have more information in there that people can use. So I think, you know, we'll go back to the networks and we'll say, okay, let's take a look at these categories again. Let's see where we need to make some changes. And every time we do it, it's just going to get better and better.
Great to hear. Well, we look forward to the next edition. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks for putting together the report itself. It's a really invaluable resource, I think, for the industry, particularly in the States. And look forward to future editions of that.
Thank you so much. And thanks for A1 support. We wouldn't be able to do it without you. You were some of the people that helped kick this whole thing off from the very beginning 5 years ago when we started doing it. So that's really important to us at the PMA.
So I'm now joined by Joe Sanfilippo, Manager of Growth and Partnerships at the US agency Today's Business. Hi, Joe. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, what's going on, Robert? Super excited to be here.
Great to have you here. Where whereabouts are you joining us from?
So I am based in Chicago, Illinois.
Perfect. To start off, can you just tell us a bit about who Today's Business are in the world of agencies out in the US?
Yeah, would absolutely love to do that. So Today's Business, we are a team of around 30 amazing people who come together to deliver the entire package when it comes to digital marketing. So brands come to us to have us audit their current situation, implement the right tracking metrics, create a tailored marketing strategy, and execute upon that strategy, and ultimately monitor the KPIs and the goals that we set forth to continuously optimize and enhance that strategy. So we've been around since 2011. We were one of the first social media marketing agencies back then. And over the past 10 years, we've really evolved into a multi-channel digital agency who have helped thousands of clients spanning across 30 different industries, from healthcare, luxury real estate, mortgage companies, to e-commerce brands, which is obviously the big, the big part of where our affiliate and our influencer marketing services come in, is with those e-commerce brands. We're really big in the men's fashion space, food, health and wellness, home and garden are some of the top industries within our e-commerce division. We really just help brands identify pain points and come up with an execution plan to help acquire new customers and ultimately grow their bottom line.
Well, we wanted to talk to you specifically today just about one of those brands. And we wanted to talk specifically about the recent US Partnerships Award shortlisted partnership that you've got with the sunglasses brand, Tomahawk Shades, which isn't a brand that I was particularly familiar with, relatively niche and kind of local to kind of the States. So could you tell us a bit about that brand and how you came to work with them and what the original goals that they set for Today's Business as an agency in supporting them?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a little bit of a long story, but I'll try to be quick. So how we connected with the team at Tomahawk Shades was through our shared love of the sport of lacrosse. So okay. The founders of Tomahawk Shades, Andrew and Ryan Shapiro, are both really big lacrosse fans, and their entire customer base was pretty much built through the lacrosse community up until they discovered us. And, you know, here at Today's Business, we have deep ties in the lacrosse community as well. I am actually one of the original investors in the Premier Lacrosse League, which is the number one lacrosse league in the world, as well as my business partners, Tom Otiano, who is our CEO here at Today's Business, Billy Ash, our chief digital officer, and Chris Hogan, who's one of our advisors and investors. So it all really kind of stemmed from Chris Hogan. Chris Hogan's a two-time Super Bowl champion for the New England Patriots and is kind of a legend in the lacrosse space because he actually didn't play football in college, but rather played 4 years of lacrosse at Penn State University. So he has a really unique story that the NFL community loved. The lacrosse community really loved how he was promoting the sport within the NFL. And ultimately, the Tomahawk Shades team had reached out to us wanting to work with Chris. But once we started talking to them, looking at how they were set up from a digital marketing standpoint and looking at the business, we really found that it honestly made sense for us to explore a deeper partnership where we could help manage all of their digital marketing efforts in addition to just having Chris be a, you know, partner and promoter of the brand. So it really turned into a more in-depth partnership. And, you know, their goal from the beginning was really just to find ways to increase revenue without dumping a ton of money into ads, as they're, you know, very limited with cash flow at the time. And, you know, they just needed to find a way to increase their customer acquisition, brand awareness, and their revenue. And that's really when we started talking about affiliate marketing and digital marketing with them.
Yeah, that makes sense. Really, like the marketing strategy that you landed upon as an agency was really based on this idea of building brand awareness by establishing those relationships with influential writers and journalists in the men's fashion and apparel sector. So, and the affiliates was obviously a great means of being able to coordinate and to measure those partnerships themselves. So can you tell us a bit about how you went about doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, to begin, it was really about getting the product in front of writers and editors and people that kind of have the influence within the publishing space. And how we did that was, you know, we use SEMrush's keyword overview and keyword magic tool to find all of the keywords that were relevant for Tomahawk Shades, but weren't branded keywords, right? So best sunglasses for men, best blue light glasses for men, best sunglasses for women, you know, gift ideas for dad, all of those things that are relevant to the brand were, you know, people that aren't searching for the brand but are looking for that type of product would end up, and we wanted to get in there, right? So how do you get in there? Well, you know, we've been doing this for a while. We figured it out. But what we've identified is, you know, really bringing in some of the writers and freelance writers and some of the editors at some of the publications and bringing them in for interviews and just, you know, paying them for their time and saying, hey, like, tell us about how it works. How does the process work of getting featured? When do articles typically get updated? How can we, you know, position ourselves as a good fit for an article? And they kind of, you know, gave us a lot of the tips and you know, inside scoop on how the industry works. And basically we listened, identified people's challenges, and created a strategy to, you know, get into those articles. And it really comes down to one, having a good product. And fortunately for us, the product of Tomahawk Shades is really tremendous. The brand's not really well known, but their product actually, you know, it kind of speaks for itself. Everyone that once we got it into the hands of the people that we needed to, you know, I think quickly they realized, oh, wow, this is a really cool brand. They're working with a lot of athletes and influencers, and they have a really nice aesthetic. And the product's actually really good without the price tag of a Ray-Ban or some of those bigger, you know, more traditional sunglass brands.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. I think it's really interesting as well, that whole almost market research strategy that you've obviously initiated there, which you would expect from maybe a consumer-facing brand, but where you're an agency managing a brand and thinking about their marketing relationships, to actually go out and speak to those journalists, I think is quite a novel approach in some ways, and something that many people wouldn't think to do. And obviously by identifying those strategies that you can use to kind of connect more deeply and target more effectively those journalists and influencers within that sector, that's been a hugely successful tactic for you guys. Were there any like major hurdles that you had to overcome in establishing those relationships when it came to actually contacting the journalists that you'd identified?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, once we connected the journalist to the articles that we were wanting to get into, the next step is reaching out to them, right? So finding contact information is generally fairly easy. The problem is finding contact information is generally pretty easy. So these people are getting bombarded by every brand and every, you know, not even just sunglasses brands, but people in the men's fashion space and the accessory space, et cetera, constantly. So how do you break through that noise? How do you kind of get through that? And, you know, really having that market research helped us find some key tactics that we implemented into our strategy that were able to help us overcome that. So a lot of times, you know, people get blasted with emails and, you know, automated emails that are very templated and you know, not really have any sort of human touch or personal element. So what we really did was we started just making little quick 30-second videos using Cloud App or just our phones sometimes, and just kind of talking about the product, saying, hey, you know, just reaching out, don't want to waste your time, notice that you write about this type of topic and wanted to show you these sunglasses. They have polarized lenses. They're under $35. They're worn by X, Y, and Z influencers. They've sold out 3 times this year and they're just back in stock, wearing them right now. You know, check out the spring hinges on them. They're super durable. And would make these little quick pitches in a video and send them to people through a direct message, where maybe they're not getting as much, you know, inbound incoming like messages through there. And it's a little bit more personal. It shows that we're real humans behind the brand. We really actually do believe in the product and stand by it. And I think, you know, the results were, they kind of speak for themselves. Like, it really worked, you know, tremendously. Yeah.
Well, that was going to be my next question, actually. What kind of success did you have in actually securing that coverage in kind of relevant publications?
The success was great. I mean, we have been featured in some of the biggest publications that you can think of in the men's fashion and the women's fashion space, whether it be Business Insider, Men's Health, Men's Journal, GQ, pretty much all of the... You know, there's not too many of the major publications that I can think of that we weren't able to get some sort of coverage in. So, yeah, it was really a successful strategy for that for Tom Hawkshades that we've started to kind of bring over to a lot of the other clients that we work with.
Yeah, yeah. And in terms of the results for the campaign itself, what kind of results have you seen off the back of these placements that you've managed to secure?
Yeah. So from a just overall company standpoint, basically doubled their revenue from the time that we had started this campaign. From a branding standpoint, they were able to get their Instagram account verified, which was huge for them, which has led to a lot of other partnerships because of that enhanced brand, you know, recognition. Then the affiliate channel.
Do you think that verification, sorry, just to jump in there, that verification then is something that's almost been a consequence of the brand authority, that they've been recognized in these wider publications that have that reach and that kind of status?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah. And I think the credibility it brings to the brand is outstanding. And that's like, I mean, The affiliate channel, going back into the results, has been the strongest channel by far. We literally make up more than 30% of the e-commerce revenue. Sometimes we're hovering around the 40% range. And like the success from a revenue standpoint has been outstanding, but like the brand will even come back to us sometimes and they're like, I think they care more about the IG verification than they do even the revenue. That like, that was something that they were like, was a huge, huge milestone for them from the day they started the company. And just having that credibility and that feeling of accomplishment that you're, you know, verified and that, you know, one of the biggest platforms in the world recognizes you, was super important to them. But going into that as well, like, you know, with the revenue increases from the affiliate channel, that saved the brand so much money in ads. Like they didn't have to go and spend tons of money on ads, and they were able to use the excess revenue to purchase more inventory, which was another issue that they had faced in the past, was not having enough inventory because they didn't have enough demand and they didn't have enough cash flow to support it. So it really, you know, from the ground up, it completely changed the company.
Brilliant. And do you think that Tomahawk Shades themselves, they were surprised by the success that you guys had had in implementing this strategy? And I guess as a consequence of the results that you brought to them, has their perception of what they can actually achieve within the channel changed as well?
I don't think they were totally surprised, because we went into it with a lot of confidence. And we definitely are very confident in our approach and kind of gave them pretty high expectations. But they have 100% been extremely satisfied with the partnership. Like I mentioned before, we've really helped grow this business tremendously and have helped taken the brand to new heights. We've really educated the Tomahawk team along the way on how the industry works, how affiliate marketing works. And we have a really close relationship with them at this time. And I mean, honestly, Andrew and Ryan are not only my business partners, but they're kind of like two of my best friends at this point, you know, with how closely we've worked with them over the past couple of years.
Looking to the future, how are you going to continue to use affiliate partnerships to support the brand? Are you evolving some of the strategies? Are you continuing along this path in terms of trying to secure those kind of influential media placements that you've managed to do so far?
Yeah, so I think from a content standpoint, we certainly haven't stopped. It's definitely no stopping there, all gas, no brakes. And you know, what's nice about the team at Tomahawk is we're super nimble, open-minded to anything. We'll try pretty much anything so long as like the lift isn't crazy. So we explore content, we explore cashback, loyalty partnerships. We're doing a lot of like exclusive codes with athletes and influencers and paying them out on exclusive codes. We're doing email publications, you name it. Like we're pretty much down for anything. And really, if there's an opportunity to acquire a new customer, we're all for it, because we know that once people hear about us and try our products, they're definitely going to come back for more. So it's all about new customer acquisition, and anybody that has an audience that can, you know, get us in front of that audience and help us pick up one or two new customers even, we're in for it, because we know it'll definitely lead to more business in the long run.
Yeah, I think that's a really great kind of open, progressive approach with it. And there are so many opportunities. Like the channel is so diverse in terms of the types of partnerships and the type of campaign that you can run through it. So that open-minded approach, I think, is always an extremely positive thing to have. Well, Joe, thanks so much for dropping into the podcast to tell us more about that. And obviously, best of luck for the awards ceremony. I think it's September 7th it's happening. So fingers crossed for that particular award.
Yeah, no, so happy I could join the podcast. Really appreciate you having me, Robert. And this was great.
Cheers. Bye.
Yep. Have a good one.
Thanks to both Joe and Trisha there for taking the time to chat to us on the podcast today. And do look out for the Tomahawk Shades case study on the AWIN blog that describes the campaign Joe and I were just chatting about. That will be published on the blog very soon. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the results from the US Partnership Awards will likely be announced by the time this episode airs, so we'll revisit those results in our next podcast. And interestingly, Kev, interesting for you and me at least, that episode will actually be our 50th. So who'd have thought we'd make it this far?
Are you sure it's actually our 50th and we just didn't screw the numbering up again?
Well, no, we did do that for a while, but I think we've managed to sort that out. So okay. I'm pretty confident that is our 50th episode.
Wow.
To celebrate, we're going to have some fun on the... I'm doing all this in air quotes, which isn't ideal for a podcast, but we'll have some fun on the 50th episode, and the plan is to host an affiliate-themed quiz, which will also involve a couple of colleagues from our US office, so stay tuned for that. The US Partnership Awards aren't the only ones that we're currently involved in, though, as Awin have also been nominated for a Marketing Week Award for its work with Simply Cook and MyProtein, which is a great example of a brand partnership campaign. And speaking of brand partnerships, Awin also recently announced new strategic partnerships with two customer rewards solutions that can help create and power offer portals on advertiser sites without needing the resource to develop these themselves. So Awin's partnership with both Tivizo and Propello means that an advertiser can set up a bespoke customer reward portal featuring offers from relevant complementary brands within minutes. And Lee Metters, who leads the brand partnerships team here at Awin and who spearheaded those partnerships, will hopefully get him on an episode soon to tell us more about those and what else has been happening in the brand partnership space recently. And finally, we hosted our Black Tie Gala event last week for the first time in 3 years, which was a fantastic opportunity to get together with a wide variety of clients and industry peers. It was a Studio 54 themed disco event, and everyone there seemed to enjoy themselves. Now, if you were there and you want to relive the night, or if you weren't, but you want to see what Kevin looks like throwing shapes to Night Fever and Staying Alive on the dance floor, you can check out the photos from the night on the Awin blog, which I'll include links to for this episode. Did you enjoy your evening, Kev, at the Black Tie?
I did, indeed. We were right next to the dance floor, so it's very accessible.
Very accessible.
I mean, it was good to see that you were fussed up there as soon as the music started.
Yeah, pulled a hamstring though, didn't I?
Did you?
Only thing I pulled all night.
I was trying to find the joke, but didn't know whether it's appropriate or not.
Yeah, I already went in there for you, preempted.
No, it was a really good night. Everyone seemed to really enjoy themselves. I kind of like had forgotten what they were like, really, because it's 3 years since we've done one. But it was great. There were so many people there that I hadn't seen for so long, and it just sort of the evening goes by so quickly that you think, oh, I've got like, I don't know, 8 hours to get around and chat to people. And invariably that sort of very much tails off towards the end of the evening. And even if you are chatting to people at the end of the evening, then it tends to be maybe a little bit blurry, the recollection.
Yeah. Well, speak for yourself. Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's episode of Awin Talks. So it's goodbye from me and goodbye from Kev.
Goodbye.